This is the You Are a Resilient Woman podcast with September Burton. I am a domestic abuse, stalking, and family court abuse survivor. I speak because I believe that there is a magic that happens when women heal together. For every woman who speaks, she empowers thousands of other women. Stand with me, speak with me, heal with me. Go to allihaveleftismyvoice.com to read my story.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please go to change.org/September Burton to sign my petition to help me hold an abuser accountable and get my children back.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the You Are a Resilient Woman podcast. I am your host, September Burton. Today, I have Kathy Linz with me. And Kathy is somebody who talks a lot and does a lot of training about PTSD and trauma and tries to really train people and teach people about what this really means and what it really looks like. But Kathy does have a story of her own, which is how she got into this work in the first place. So Kathy, will you kind of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit of your background and your story?
Sure. If you would say, you know, saw me as a kid, you'd be like, well, it's a typical kid from Wisconsin. Grew up on a dairy farm, went to the UW-Madison, Badgers, let's go all the way. I mean, most of the things in my life, you'd be like, well, that's like just like every other kid out there, you know, pretty normal, pretty common. And it always surprises people at some point where I actually came from. What no one talked about was that there was a lot of abuse in my house. And for me, it was one of those times where when I was even still quite young, I experienced a lot of neglect, a lot of physical beatings. And I have to tell you, there are things I didn't like fully comprehend until later as I was working on healing. But it was I was dealing with that kind of abuse. My mother unexpectedly died. She was one of the main abusers that I had at that time. And I remember going through therapy at one point and thinking to myself, you know, like there was this, actually this relief at that moment of like, you know, like that would end. And as soon as that ended, I had another family member who said, you know, my father was upset. He really couldn't take care of the six kids at that point. And he had another family member who said, don't worry about it, I'll take care of them. Who knew that we were being groomed to be sexually assaulted, you know, 3 weeks after my mother's funeral? I was 6 years old at that point. So I'm not the middle kid of six kids. I remember all the times of the social services showing up on our doorstep. And that's the only time I ever remember our farmhouse door being locked, and they're yelling in, Mr. Linz, you can't raise your children this way. You're below the poverty line. And him screaming at them obscenities to get the hell off his farm. And I'm just terrifying as this little kid watching, like, what's going on? And the dynamics that went into that of what was happening at that moment. I wish I could say that that's where the abuse ended, but it just, I have to admit, I've talked with other abuse survivors and I said, you know, sometimes it feels like there's a mark on our head. Like, how do abusers know? And so it was just experience after experience, trying to get out of childhood even, that popped up with medical professionals who took advantage and other folks who took advantage. And I remember I left because I started school at the age of 4. And according to my family members, it was because my mother wanted me out of her way and out of the house. So I started kindergarten at 4. So I graduated at 17. So I left home and left for college and just never went back. And people were like, but you're only 17 years old. And it's like, and I needed to get myself out. Yeah. And I remember thinking to myself, this is a fresh start. I'm going to leave all of that buried and back, and it's gone and out of my life, and I'm going to live my life. And I did a lot of exciting things. I was working as a 4-H agent. I had an opportunity to travel for 6 months to Costa Rica, and I took it. You know, people were like, you're going to be killed. Are you out of your mind? I'm like, no, I'm going. And I just remember coming back and showing my grandmother the pictures that I had and her saying to me, I wish I had done that when I was little. And I thought, I don't ever want to get to be 90 some years old and wishing that I had done that.
Yeah.
So then from there on in, it was just like, let's go, folks. I was out doing trainings as a, you know, with the 4-H, working eventually for the Department of Transportation, got a call. Will you go to train Peace Corps volunteers down in Guatemala? Okay, sure. I'm gullible that way. I was a risk taker. And that doesn't mean that I didn't run into challenges along the way. And again, that same thing of, do I have something on my forehead? It just seemed like if there was someone who was going to be attacked, threatened, or something, man, I could find them like nobody's business. But I was living my life thinking, well, it is what it is, and I'm making the best of it and doing what I can. And it was interesting because by the time I hit my 30s, it was like this comeuppance moment of me keep running into things that I couldn't ignore. For what I mean by that, for example, is I suddenly had a tumor that was growing very, very rapidly on my back. And my sibling started calling my tumor Quasimodo because it was protruding so much. I'm like, thank you very much for your support. And the doctors were concerned because they were just like, well, that just came out of nowhere. And I went in and they did a procedure actually in the, not the operating room, but a procedural room. And as he made the incision, he stopped and he said to me, ma'am, I'm required by law to tell you that I'm a mandatory reporter. And I stopped and I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're trying to tell me. And he said, I just made an incision across your back. Because of that incision, I can now see your entire back underneath your skin. Ma'am, your entire back is covered in scar tissue. The scar tissue is multiple layers thick. You've clearly been someone's punching bag for a long time now. I'm mandatory reporter, and I cannot allow you to leave the clinic today unless I know you will be safe in your home and you can prove that to me. And it was just one of those moments like I was not prepared to deal with that. And I'm just like, I haven't been beaten like that since I was a kid. I live alone with my dog. I'll be perfectly safe. And he's like, knowing that those kind of tumors form in old injuries. And he said, from what I can see, you're covered in old injuries. And so it was like this coming back to haunt me of this, you know, needing to address this, but it kept showing up and kept showing up. I got called in for jury duty, and I'm being a good citizen. I went, and I got called in at the county. I got called in at the state. I got called in at the feds. My police friends were like, no one is that lucky that you would get called in repeatedly at every level of court. And every time I got called in, this is a case about domestic violence. This is a case about anxiety. This is a case about, does anybody here have anything similar to that? And I raised my hand. And literally the judge looked at me and said, tell me your story, ma'am. And I'm like, here? In court? And so what could I do? I'm like, I'm in court. I have to tell them the truth. I told him, and he stopped and he looked at me, goes, ma'am, have you ever reported any of this? And I'm like, he's dead. He's died. And she's like, he's just like, does anybody else have anything else similar to hers? And whatever hands went up, he goes, okay, all of you are already dismissed. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm the only one who gets called out? How? And my friends again are like, how lucky are you? Wow. And I come at life from a faith-based background and approach to things. And so I'm a true believer that it's not by accident. I had felt up to that point because of my faith life and prayer life of God continually saying to me, we need to talk about this. And me going, leave it alone. Leave it buried. It's fine. We're fine. We're all fine. We don't need to be talking about this. And I finally hit my 40s and I actually experienced yet another abusive situation, actually a series of them. A stalker from an online course, who'd have thought that would happen? A guy I'd never met, completely infatuated, followed by yet another incident that happened as well. And I'm just kind of like, Lord, really? And I remember joining a class on Lord Teach Me to Pray. It's following the Ignatian exercises, where it's the whole point of what Ignatius was trying to teach about was, what is it that separates you from God? Are you willing to be in a dialogue with God on that topic? And I just remember after I had signed up and spent my first time at prayer using their processes and techniques, having God say, Kath, you know what? I'm glad that you signed up. We need to talk about the abuse. And I'm like, oh, no, you didn't. Oh, no, you didn't. And it's like, hey, you signed up. I didn't make you. And I just finally hit that point of, I give up. God, I can't outrun you. I can't. And I had what most people, for me as a high functioning, it was a terrible breakdown. Anyone else around me looks at me and says, but you were still power of attorney and taking care of two different people. You were still running your business. You were still, and I knew I was not functioning well at all. I had days and nights where I was just, I crashed. And at that point, it really became the leaning in on prayer for like, Lord, teach me to pray. Having conversations with other people who were in church who said, have you considered looking at some of these different ministries? One of them was Grief to Grace. It was created by a woman who created Rachel's Vineyard. She works with people who've experienced abortions and are, you know, dealing with the grief of that situation. And what she found was that 4/5 of her participants were adult survivors of childhood sexual assault. And she said, do you realize what just happened? They've moved from one abusive relationship to another, and now they're dealing with this kind of manipulation. Here's the next thing, that same repeat of the process. So she created Grief to Grace for people who were survivors of sexual assault. I was terrified. It was the first time that I actually worked with a therapist. And I just remember the abuser who had sexually assaulted me as a 6-year-old telling people, because he set it up to make sure that I wasn't listened to. She's crazy. You can't believe anything that she says. And in my mind, if I went to a therapist, oh my gosh, I really am crazy. I really am everything that they are talking about. And so it was really having to work through a lot of that stigma, a lot of those kind of thoughts in how to actually get the help I needed. I tried out different support groups for depression, for women in depression and anxiety. And it was an interesting process. The first depression group I went to, they talked to me, the director, leader called me afterwards. He goes, you're very high functioning. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, yeah, the rest of the group is really uncomfortable. Could you go elsewhere? And I was like, okay, I'm too well for some people, but not well enough for others. It's like, that's one of those really tricky parts that happens when you happen to fall into the high functioning area. But I did find groups where I could actually go. And I found myself continually learning stuff that I didn't even know was running my life. Do you want to know what I talk about, what I mean by that, when I say that?
I have an inkling of what you mean by that because I have a very similar feeling about myself, but yeah, our listeners, please expand.
So when I went to one of the support group meetings, they started out like most support groups do, where they're just like, hi, my name is, and I'm here because, and the one woman said, I'm here because I'm a picker. And I heard that and I raised my hand and I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be intrusive in any way. Could you explain what you mean by you're a picker? And she explained about people with anxiety who may pick at their skin, who will pull at their hair, pull at their eyelashes. And I think most of your audience probably is familiar with that. I wasn't at that point. And as they're saying that, I answered her afterwards going, thank you for explaining. But in my head, I'm going, I'm a picker too? And you know, and I just remember literally like Christ being there with me and going, Kathy, Now let's look. You haven't bloodied your lip in a really long time. And look, most of your eyelashes have grown back. And I'm just like, that is not making me feel better. Just want you to know. But it was just like one of those things where like, that's what I was dealing with. And every once in a while after that, I would actually catch myself where I might pick at my cuticles or something, and suddenly I'm bleeding profusely. And I'm like, and I'm obviously anxious. So I need to manage that. And what do I need to get on top of? The other example.
When you have an experience like that, where somebody else sort of says something and you realize, oh, I do that too. Did you find that validating? Did you find that that helped you heal from being a picker?
Actually, it was that moment of, I didn't realize everybody else in the world didn't do that. So it was just really that moment of like, okay, wait a minute. That's not what everybody else does. Why am I doing that? What's driving that behavior? And what is it that I actually need to manage and work with and think about to get to the other side? It was that same kind of thing where, I'm going to do just the very short story. I came to realize that when I get anxious, I tend to ask people, are you angry? Please don't be angry. Is everything okay? I observed that behavior in someone else, and I thought it was fascinating because at one point I asked them, why were they asking me that? And they were like, I've asked you that? What? And I realized, wow, that's all happening subconsciously. And it wasn't until I was explaining it to someone else, another of my friends for a long time, what I had seen. And she's like, you're hilarious. And I'm like, why? And she goes, you say the exact same words. I can see how you two had the same childhood because you do the same. And it was like, I had no awareness of it at all. And it was impacting my work. She said, you don't know, do you? And I'm like, what? And she goes, the other trainers laugh at you behind your back because you do it, because they see that. And it's actually become a talking point where when I'm talking and working with some of the different church groups now about like, how can we be doing better? I'm like, you actually need to intervene with people because they will make fun of that which they don't understand. And that's our opportunity. But it was like, until I saw it for myself, I had no idea it was running my life. And a bee just came on, sorry here. Oh. In case you were like, what did you just see? He landed right next to me. And I'm like, really?
That's funny.
And literally it was, I got, so there's like the church side of what I was going through, but there was also the secular side. I got invited to be a speaker at a state conference talking about peer engagement. And I took that as an opportunity to talk a little bit more about how the church can be involved, how they can be a support. Because what the research shows is that when people experience mental health challenges, the number one place that they turn to is the church. Not medical health providers, but the church. And most of the church folks are like, we don't know what to do. I talked about that in two different sessions with 45 people each, like 90 people. And they all told me very loudly, you're absolutely right. That's where we turned. And let us tell you about how we were treated. And there wasn't a good story in the bunch. And I thought, whoa. And I remember walking out of there going, God, I'm sure there's a reason why you wanted me to see that. Cause I'm not going to lie. That was painful. And I had someone stop me afterwards and she said, do you know what you just did? And I said, I'm not sure what you mean, but tell me what you saw. And she said, you listened to people. You didn't tell them they were wrong. You didn't tell them, like, you didn't invalidate them at all. You listened and you sincerely apologized for what they experienced, that was not what should be happening. And it was a real moment for me to stop and say, okay, this can't continue. This has to shift. And I actually started pulling together people from the community, from community groups, as well as church groups, and say, let's create gatherings in mental health. And let's start getting the community to talk about this, bringing people together. And we had great, and it was one of those funny things where people from the local area didn't want to come to the local area because they didn't want anyone to know. But lots of people from other areas came because they didn't want to talk about it in their areas. They wanted to talk about where they felt it was safe. But it got us started in the process of getting some of our local law enforcement, our social services, all of those different folks, getting them to talk to one another. And I think it opened up a lot of venues for myself and for others. We tried to make sure that we had a mixture of service providers who spoke, but also people living with mental health challenges, whatever kind those might be, that were actually leading sessions. And it was funny because some of the ones who said, I'd like to do that, but I'm not sure how to get involved. And I'm like, would you like to talk about how to present? If you would. And so I'm like giving some coaching and things to work through. And I had so many who either called me themselves, their family members called me afterwards because they were teenagers and said, you have no idea what you've just done. They are now trying new things they never would have tried before because they saw the opportunity. You believed in them. You saw beyond whatever mental health challenge they were having and saw the opportunity. And that's what I think is the other part that we've got to be for each other is, can we see beyond the labels and the stigma and everything else to be there and provide those openings for one another? So it's been that kind of stuff that I've been kind of trying to build on, work on. And where I've come to at this point is working on gather my lost sheep. After much discernment, just felt like Christ just saying, I need you to form, gather my lost sheep. And I literally need you to gather my lost sheep. The people who have been pushed away, chased away for whatever story that people had. And I said to the two priests that I'm working with on it, they said, well, should we start with the people who are living with trauma? And I said, gang, here's the thing. If we don't start with the church first, they're going to walk into church and experience the same terrible behavior that they experienced before. And you are never going to get them back. We've got to change what's happening in the church. We've got to talk about, like, how do we work with one another? And so we've created, we have a private Facebook group. And we do training within that safe, that kind of setting, that safer setting. And so we have done a series of three trainings, actually building it on what is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration say, as well as what do we know from church teaching and documents, because it's not like it's the first time the church has talked about it, even though most people seem to completely have missed that part, and say, here's what we're called to as Catholics. How do we do this work? How do we begin? It's been amazing because we've gotten coverage with the National Catholic Register, the National Paper, some of the other different podcasts for the Catholic side of the world. And as part of that, then we've now have approximately 70 members who have joined within the last 2 months from across the country. And in fact, somebody from Canada is now part of the group. So getting places to actually talk about it, work on it. And I have to say that it's been my work as well as the work for that I may do for others to provide openings and possibilities, because it's taken me a lot to work through things of that fear of, you know, am I going to experience abuse again? Am I going to have to deal with this again? And I've also have come to the realization that, yeah, actually I may, because I'm going to run into occasionally church people who just don't get it yet. And I hit the mixture of people who don't get it. And then I have other people who I put flyers and Facebook and everything else out there. And they contact me back and they're like, this is impacting my family, my friends, my praise God. Thank you. Thank you for speaking up and saying something that other people won't talk about. So, you know, one of the things we talked about earlier is I said, you know, it's the, I come to a certain level of healing and I continue to do my best to function and do the work that I do. But then something else comes up, something else comes up. I mean, I won't lie. Tomorrow, the McCarrick report is coming out. That's, they've been waiting for 2 years for Cardinal McCarrick, who was found to be, you know, molesting seminarians and molesting children. It's been buried up to for 2 years up to now, and it's finally being released tomorrow. I know some of the people and the victims who were some of his victims. It's hard for me to hear some of that thing and not get sucked in. And so it really becomes the, okay, what's the self-care I can do today? What do I have to do to really pay attention to what's going to best serve me right now? And if it means that I need to withdraw for a bit, it means that I need to withdraw for right now.
I like the way that you just said that, because it really is about, I think it's an everyday venture. Really, it's an everyday thing that you have to ask yourself on a daily basis, what is the self-care that I need today? And, you know, what's interesting for me is that learning the power of speaking up, and I get emails, I get messages all the time from women saying, thank you for being transparent. Thank you for sharing your story because it validates what other people are going through. I remember the first book that I read on this type of abuse that I experienced, one of the first things that it said was, you believe that you're crazy. And I thought, oh my God, somebody gets it. Like, I thought I was crazy. And then just to have that validated is so powerful. So I think that's part of the speaking and telling your story and just simply letting people see your pain. It's that gives space for empathy. And I really think that healing at the end of the day is all about the empathy that we experience between each other.
Mm-hmm. And we offer that opening. Yes. And that's really what I've started to talk about with, because from the people who have not experienced trauma, part of what we've talked about in the training is to say, well, what's happening exactly when someone has a flashback? What's happening in the brain? What's happening that you can see? Why is that happening the way that it is? And they're just like, wow, I hadn't considered that possibility at all. Like, that's what's going on. And now they're like, now that you say that, their behavior makes perfect sense to me. And I'm like,
yeah,
you know, just something to think about. If we understand context, not that it's any of your business to know everyone's context, but I'm just saying.
So I'd be curious.
More sense.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on what do you think the healing power is of speaking up and telling your story, of not from what I was saying before of somebody else hearing my story, but somebody else who chooses after hearing my story to speak up and tell their story. Why do you think that helps heal them?
I think it's partly because it's one of the things that I came across was realizing that our tendency is to only look at the good in our life and not to look and do everything we can to bury the bad.
Yeah.
Like, that's not us. That's not us. And what I've noticed is that when we can't own the bad in our lives, that part of it will always run us. It's running our life. And what I've come to realize is that when the day that I could own not only the good, but the bad, I now had freedom to choose. This wasn't something to be afraid of, ashamed of anymore.
Yeah.
And that is what made it so freeing. And what I've actually had, and if you had talked to me earlier in my life, I would have told you this is not who I am. I actually had a person come up at one of my trainings once and said, I've never met anyone who is so comfortable in their own skin. And I thought, wow, this is a moment.
That's a gift.
Because one of the things that we talk about is when you've experienced this from childhood, from early years on, people were like, well, who were you before the trauma? It's like, I have no idea. I don't know anything other than living with trauma. That is the only thing that I know. And the other part that was fascinating is when one of my friends who is a therapist said to me, well, Kathy, here's the interesting part. You don't know who you would have been, but now you get to choose and create who are you going forward.
I like that.
And that was exciting and terrifying all at the same time. Like, and it was just like that, like, okay, really, like, what do I want? What would that look like?
Yeah.
What's possible if?
I like that a lot. One of the experiences that I had with a therapist that I was working with several months ago was I kind of came to the same realization. Like, I had experienced childhood abuse. I didn't know how to live without trauma. I didn't even know what it meant. And it was when I was working with her, I realized I don't know what it means to live without trauma. And so the next session that we had, I asked her, what does it look like? Like, what? I don't even know what it looks like. Can you help me? And so we kind of explored it for a few minutes. And at the end of the day, what we came up with is it's when you have control over your emotions and you're non-reactionary and, you know, things like that. You are so poised and so grounded in who you are that you don't have to react to everything that other people are throwing at you. And I like
you don't
that.
Spend your time like, well, and that's where most of my life has been lived out of is the, how's everyone's mood? How's everybody doing?
Yeah.
If they're angry, this is about to turn very violent.
Yeah.
Very violent.
Yeah, same. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, you've talked about a lot about your work, but I guess I want to know, can you give some sort of inspirational, like, words of wisdom to somebody who may be listening to this, who's still experiencing abuse, or maybe just getting out of abuse and just starting the healing process? Can you help them out? Like, where do they go from here?
This is that opportunity where you need, I came to the point where I realized I really do need to work with a therapist, mm-hmm. and I need to back away from like whatever stories I have about the therapy to truly be in that. And the question then becomes, what's the right kind of therapy that makes sense for you? I tried talk therapy first, and I was even working with a trauma-informed therapist, but talk therapy wasn't as effective for me. So she actually referred me on to work with someone with EMDR, mm-hmm. movement desensitization and reprocessing, which I found to be extremely helpful. But that's me. That's not everybody. But it really became the figuring out, like, how best do I do this? Because in that moment of breakdown, I didn't know where to go for money. I didn't know where to go to. And what someone suggested to me was, they said, do you realize that the college nearby has a family counseling center? And you would be supervised by a therapist, but there are students who need the chance to actually work with folks. Would you consider that? It might be more in your price range and still help you get what you need just as a place to start. Particularly like if money is a problem, which for a lot of survivors in the middle of that breakdown, that's exactly where they are. I wish, and this is one of the challenges that I think is true for a number of survivors, particularly who experience childhood abuse, we don't have the best support system. And so it's really becoming, people are like, well, just go make friends. Just go. That is the hardest thing in the world when you're in the middle of breakdown.
It's not that easy. It is not.
And I had to really, I admit for me, I turned in faith. I was with one community, and because of what was happening with one of the priests there, I had to pull out, and I ended up going to another parish. And I said to the bishop, I said, you know what? I was not in a good place at that point. I couldn't have made new friends on my own. I wasn't doing well enough to do that. And I said, honestly, what happened was I was sitting in church sobbing after Mass one day. And an older lady came in, and she's like, oh, honey, what's wrong? And I'm like, because for me, belonging is a big deal. Like, I felt like I never belonged anywhere. And to have to move from that community where I at least had some support to someplace else where I had none, it was just like, I have hit the bottom here. I don't belong anywhere. She's like, oh, of course you do. And she said afterwards, she goes, you turned and you looked at me and you said, I don't belong anywhere. And she said, at that moment, I had never seen that much pain in another human being's eyes. She said, that haunted me. And it turns out that she and other ladies in that 70 to 82 age group got together for coffee. And unbeknownst to me, and I can see it now, I couldn't see it then, there was an emergency meeting of the women's coffee group. And I became their new project. And literally, I mean, for 70 to 82 year olds, those ladies are stealth, let me tell you. They positioned themselves so that I had to run into them to get out of church and to get to my car. And if they hadn't convinced me to come to the coffee group, by the time I left the church building, there were some more to make sure that I got there.
Wow.
And they're like, we want you with us. You belong with us. You are coming with us. And that's really where I think and I talk about that within the church group to say, folks, we need to do a whole lot better. You know, we need to pay attention to how are the people doing around us and are we inviting them in? And that's really been, I think, the eye-opening conversation for folks to think about, wow, like literally, and I'm like, we're not talking rocket science, you know, difficult things. Reach out and say hi. Work with me on that. You can do that. But really, it's sometimes it's the simplest things of inclusion and invite and and just to be with where they are.
Yeah.
And I'm like, gang, can you, and what we're really hitting on is the accompaniment. Accompaniment isn't about telling them, well, you should do this and you should do that. Where are they at? What do they tell you that they need? And if it's like, do you want to talk right now? No, not really. Can I sit here and not really do anything with you? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It really can be that simple to just, you know, be with one another. And so it's sometimes figuring out, like, who do I have? Who is it that I can lean in on? And how can they help with that part of the process? But I'll admit, if the people had not intervened, I don't know what I would have done. That was the hardest part. And I praise God for the people who just really noticed what was happening and said, we've got to do something different and better. There are still some of my best friends. And these ladies are just, it's like having lots of grandmothers, which is an amazing thing to have.
It's true. That is an amazing thing to have. I think that there's a power when women get together and women really heal each other. And I'm a reader. Well, one thing that I wanted to point out before we move on is at women's shelters, one way to get free counseling is most women's shelters will offer free counseling. And so that's a great resource. If you can't afford counseling, go to the women's shelter. I strongly recommend it. I've used their counselors and the ones that I've used are wonderful. Another thought that came up as you were talking is I'm a reader. I read about things. That's how I get a lot of my understanding of and healing and things like that. So there was a book that I read right before I fled, and it was called The Power of Eight. And it's all about this woman who is a researcher, and she actually did studies to see what happens when groups of about 8 to 12 people get together and they either, you know, pray or meditate or whatever their modality is, but they're all doing it together, and not necessarily physically together, but kind of at the same time and with the same intention and things like that. And she found that the miracles that would happen when you would get a group of people together, all with the same intention, were just astounding. And it's all very scientific, you know, so it's a beautiful book. I can't remember the name of the author off the top of my head, but it's called The Power of Eight. And then another one that I read that you keep making me think of, and I don't remember the title of it off the top of my head, but it's about the power of listening. And it's about how most people don't know how to listen. We listen to respond rather than listening to actually truly listen and hear. And I love what you say about really what does that individual person need? And the only way that you're going to learn that is to listen to them. And so there is such a power in listening to somebody and just holding space for them to tell their story. So thank you for that. I really appreciate you saying that.
I'm a bookie myself, and there's another one out there that's called Suffering in the Heart of God. And it's trauma destroys, Christ heals. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece that really helps explain about, like, again, what's happening. And I have to admit, I read and read and read to understand what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
Always looking for, and that's actually the thing that I think is most interesting. I've had people say, Kathy, there's a lot of people who can talk about what it's like to do the science of it, but they can't necessarily communicate what that means to live with it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can do both is a real rare thing.
That's a gift, for sure. That's a gift. So a gift for yourself and a gift to the world, a gift to all of the people that you're trying to help heal. So that's beautiful. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for coming on the show today, for sharing your story, for talking about how to heal from trauma, PTSD, all of those things. If you have any final words of wisdom you want to leave, or inspirational thoughts or anything like that, that you want to leave listeners with?
The biggest thing is, on those hard days, give yourself some space to just sit back. Don't try to make any of the big decisions. Take some space for yourself. I love painting. I signed up for a water aerobics class, and those kind of things were so helpful in the midst of whatever else was happening, to get that chance to move, to express. People said to me, how do you do that? And I'm like, you know, 2 hours of painting and I can have a painting done. And I just feel so refreshed from that process. But just really give yourself that space. Don't push. I have to. It's like, no.
Yeah.
the best health care you can do right now is just to give yourself some space to work through it.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that you just mentioned the art too, and that is another type of therapy actually that you can get into, is there is art therapy out there. So that is another very, very healing thing that you can do for yourself. Again, thank you so much, Kathy. It was great. It was such an honor to have you on today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you're in danger, call 911 and your local women's shelter. Get yourself safe so you can begin to heal. And when you're ready, reach out. You have a tribe. You have support. Find me at alliehaveleftismyvoice.com or on any social channel as September Burton.